This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Forest Park is huge. It's also home to a vast array of wildlife. But it's notable that the arterial roads surrounding the park don't seem to have quite as many roadkill victims as other roadways and highways. Does reality reflect that presumption? And if so, why? A new study about how raccoons navigate in and around Forest Park sheds light on that question. It also gives us some insight into the secret lives of St. Louis raccoons. Joining us now to talk about that are St. Louis researchers who contributed to a paper that's featured in the December issue of the Journal of Mammalogy. Dr. Sharon Dean is a wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist and director of the St. Louis Zoo Institute for Conservation Medicine. Dr. Dean, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And we also have Steve Blake, an assistant professor of biology at St. Louis University. Welcome back to you as well, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Now, you both are also co-principal investigators of this Forest Park Living Lab, which tracks raccoons and 15 other species within the park. And we'll learn a little bit more about the mission of your lab in a bit. But first, let's talk about this latest study. Using GPS collars, you track the whereabouts and movements of 10 raccoons living in Forest Park between 2021 and 2024. What question did you set out to answer, Dr. Dean?
So a number of questions. First of all, we're just so interested in how the raccoons are using the park as well as the areas around the park. What do they do? How do they spend their days? And more importantly, how do they spend their nights? And so really we were looking at understanding their behavior and movement within the habitat, and most importantly, how that intersection or interaction with humans as we're using the park as well.
Mm-hmm. What did you know about that before embarking on this study, Steve?
Well, there was a great master's study done by one of the employees at the St. Louis Zoo that showed that raccoons have pretty big home ranges. A lot of them were using kind of over half the park. But that was with radio telemetry, and there's some rather larger margin for error with radio tags than you might get with GPS collars that we used. So we were really asking fundamental questions, like Sharon said, of, you know, what are these things doing? How are they using space within the park?
Mm-hmm. And what did you discover, let's see, from these GPS collars, Steve?
Well, we showed that home ranges aren't perhaps quite as big as we thought they were. A number of the raccoons had very small home ranges. For example, if listeners know the geography of Forest Park, a few animals had home ranges that occupied, say, the Kennedy Forest, that's maybe a few tens of acres. Others had somewhat larger ranges. But what we did find was this interesting interaction between raccoon movements and roads.
Mm-hmm. How does a raccoon, or what does it need in a home range before we get to that movement part? And how do they use their space, Dr. Dean?
Sure. So as is true of so many of the wildlife species out there, and particularly in our urban areas, what they need is the ability to eat, to mate, and to sleep, right? So kind of the basics of life, and really they need to have an area that can provide all those parts of life.
So then raccoons avoiding these streets, crossing them, even when there is on the other side, you know, trash cans and other discarded food sources, why are they not crossing in order to get to that?
So one of the things we should mention, that raccoons are incredibly intelligent, right? They're this incredibly intelligent species that is one of the most recognized mammal in our country, right? So they're smart, and they in urban areas often have access to human food, so trash, as we know. Mm-hmm. But they're also understanding that the roads are dangerous, the noise and the vehicles, and so the ones that are surviving are probably probably the ones that understand it's best to utilize the food sources from humans that are not, quote, on the other side of the road.
Mm-hmm. So with the road types as well, did the raccoons that you were tracking avoid crossing some of those smaller roads within Forest Park in addition to the larger arterial ones around, Steve?
Indeed they did, and our study actually just looked at road crossings within Forest Park. Mm. What we didn't mention, well, we mentioned it in the paper, but one of the really interesting things about the study was one raccoon, I think called Frankie, who about three nights out of six would cross I-64 and go into Dogtown. Mm-hmm. And in Dogtown, he had a tiny little home range. In Forest Park, he used all of sort of Kennedy Forest. And we're thinking, how on earth is he doing that? But it turns out he was using the culverts, the drainage culverts, mm-hmm. that go under I-64. And we put a camera trap up on there, and loads of raccoons are scuttling between Forest Park and Dogtown to go and hang out in the dumpsters and take advantage of all the food sources over there.
What was it like to look at that footage?
So, yeah, we had quite a few camera traps throughout the park. And actually, you mentioned this article that we're talking about is in the December issue of Journal of Mammalogy. And one of those camera traps is this incredible picture we have of multiple raccoons looking at a white-tailed deer. So whenever we see these pictures, it's really heartening to kind of get a peek into the secret lives of these animals throughout mm-hmm. the park.
Yeah, and so we download the data from these GPS collars with a radio, like a Bluetooth radio. And so we'd have to go and track them. And I'd be wandering around Dogtown at midnight with a radio antenna and a big radio. And one day I remember, so I kept thinking, I'm going to get my head kicked in if somebody finds me scooting around here. And one night someone came out and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'll give you 500 guesses and you'll never get it." So we radio tracked together and we found this raccoon in a dumpster.
Was it eating busily?
No, it was fast asleep.
Oh, it was.
with a full belly.
We'll get to something related to that a little bit later. What is a camera trap?
Yes, so camera traps are used a lot in ecological studies. And so they're remotely sensed. So if there's movement, nobody's around, you set your camera up, but when there's movement, they're collecting pictures for you. And then later, you can look at those pictures back in the lab.
Mm-hmm. How did you track these raccoons through these collars? Did you, you know, capture and release them one by one?
Yeah, so this process takes a little bit of logistical planning, and we use have-a-hearts where we set traps out in the evening that are baited with dry and wet cat food, which raccoons seem to very much appreciate. Mm-hmm. And so trapping the raccoons, we usually would go set them at night and at first light go out and check whether we caught any of the raccoons. And most nights we'd catch one to three raccoon and then be able to work it up in the morning to put the tags on, mm-hmm. the telemetry tags.
You compared these raccoons' movements with thousands of simulated paths. How did you come up with those for this study, Steve?
Well, actually, we didn't. And this is a good shout out for the first author of the paper, Stella Udevall, who's a statistical guru. And what she did, sorry, Stella, if I'm getting all this wrong, she came up with simulated tracks based on our movement data. So she knew how far a raccoon was traveling between every two-hour segment. But she took all of those data and she randomized them. And then she threw those randomized data out over Forest Park and then compared what real raccoons did in terms of road crossings with those simulated data that are randomly thrown out across the park.
And what was the most striking thing about what came of that, Dr. Deem?
So a few things. One is, as you pointed out at the start of this conversation, is the lack of road crossing. Mm-hmm. So really, the raccoons were intentional not to cross those roads where we we thought they might.
And we're going to pick up on the other two. We're going to take a very quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation about roadway shy raccoons who elect to stay in Forest Park instead of venturing out to scrounge for food that is readily available. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Eileen Cha. Let's return to our conversation with Dr. Sharon Deem and Professor Steve Blake. They're co-authors of a paper in the December issue of the Journal of Mammalogy that's focused on the habits of raccoons in Forest Park. They also serve as co-principal investigators of the Forest Park Living Lab. Before the break, we were talking about the main findings from this tracking of 10 raccoons in Forest Park. And Steve, I'd like you to kind of follow up with what Dr. Deem had said regarding these road crossings, and in particular, when these raccoons were most active.
Yeah, so the raccoons are nocturnal, which means they're most active at night. And they're also largely crepuscular within that, which means that they have a peak of activity before dawn and after sunset. And they're more active as the temperature increases. And interestingly, the night length influences how active they are. They're active for more hours, for more time during the long summer nights. But interestingly, while their winter nights are shorter, they're more active per hour during the winter. Mm-hmm. So it's as if they're working harder and faster to pack as much foraging into their nights when they're shorter.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound unlike humans.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, there are a number of nicknames for raccoons, mm-hmm. you know, backyard bandits, trash pandas, and these names are indicative, right, of the proximity with which we live. To raccoons and this species to species sort of interaction. And recently researchers have found evidence that raccoons are actually showing signs of domestication. Dr. Deem, what does that tell us about wildlife evolution in the Anthropocene, which is a term that refers to this period of time that we're in during which humans have had a substantial impact on our planet?
Yeah, so this recent paper is really interesting and maybe not that surprising. And it was based on, I think, 20,000 images. So sort of those camera trap and photos taken of raccoons. And it was noted that the urban raccoons are the raccoons that prefer cities where humans are. Their morphologic changes or their snout size has shortened, with it, which is actually a sign of domestication. And when we think of evolution, a lot of people think of, oh, evolution takes a long time, but actually it's can be very rapid. And a species like raccoons that are ubiquitous around the U.S., from country to rural living, we're seeing that actually this closer interaction of raccoons with humans may be leading to this change in their structure, which is a sign of domestication. And it really probably comes down to all that trash pandas can get, all that human food that's available. And so they might not have to do as much foraging or looking for food sources, and that can have structural changes.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier, Steve, you had talked about the raccoon that was passed out, sleeping soundly and full in the dumpster, Frankie. Another recent headline features a raccoon who was passed out for another reason. He was drunk in the bathroom of a liquor store in Virginia. What stands out to you about that story and this thing about humans and raccoons?
Well, first of all, who of us can say we've never been passed out and drunk in a toilet? You know.
I can't say that I... Please continue.
So, yeah, I don't quite know what to say. I mean, my mum phoned me up this morning from England and said, I've just listened to a story about a drunken raccoon on the BBC. So I think we see this, you know, drunkenness is not unique to this one raccoon. I used to work with forest elephants, and forest elephants eat rotten mangoes by the bucket load, and they get drunk on that.
Mm-hmm.
And a wide variety of animals have the tendency to get drunk when the opportunity presents itself. So maybe this raccoon isn't as odd as we think.
Mm-hmm. What does this say to us about how we as humans should be conducting ourselves in spaces that are shared with wildlife, Dr. Dean?
Yeah, so I think it's really important for all of us to realize, especially when we think of urban spaces, like 80% of us in the U.S. now live in urban spaces, and we're sharing those spaces with wildlife. So I think it's important for us to think of how our footprint and what we do, and maybe if we leave that liquor store door open, that wildlife could come in, but really to understand how close this relationship is between ourselves, our families, and in cities when we're interacting with other animals.
Mm-hmm. Raccoons are just one of 16 animal species that you all study at the Forest Park Living Lab. What is the bigger picture goal of the research that is being conducted there, Steve?
Just as our question for raccoons is fairly general. Our question for the Forest Park Living Lab has a very general component, and that is, how do wildlife survive in an urban environment, and how potentially do they thrive, and can these communities do well? How can we improve urban conditions for wildlife?
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Definitely, those are our main reasons for doing this program, and we look at the health and behavior and interactions of all these various species, that diverse species that live in Forest Park. But we also have a really large education and outreach component. Like, we are so lucky here in St. Louis to have this amazing, biodiverse, thriving city park. And so a part of our program is really to enthuse people, to get children and adults out into Forest Park and understand just what our space we're sharing with other species. So a lot of what we do is have people come out on turtle safaris or to meet a white-tailed deer or a turkey or whatever that's out in the park.
What are some of the other species you track? You've just mentioned some other animals. Are there ones that maybe people would be surprised to hear you're watching?
Yeah, and please, for those of you interested, we have a website, theforestparklivinglab.org, and all of the information is there. But maybe the ones that are most surprising are the two coyotes we collared from Forest Park a couple years ago. And I think a lot of people in our area were really interested in these urban coyote and how they use the park and the area around the park. But we've also done a number of raptor species, so owls and hawks. And one of our favorite, we don't have favorites, sorry kids.
Yeah, but right.
One of our favorite hawks, a red-tailed hawk that every year has gone up to Canada. So calls Forest Park home, mm-hmm. and that's where he was tagged, but he'll go up to the border just on the other side of Canada. Mm-hmm. Every year he makes this trip and comes back. And so that reminds us of how these species that are right here in our city are connecting us to other parts of the country and the continent.
Mm-hmm. What are maybe the biggest or perhaps most surprising discoveries you've made so far? Maybe that you find yourself talking with people about more often than not, Steve.
There are a lot, but the one that sticks in my mind is Astrid, a great horned owl, whose home range is about, who the epicenter of her world is less than 150 meters from the Children's Hospital on the other side of King's Highway.
Mm.
So 15 million people use the park every year. Astrid sees most of them, and almost none of them know she even exists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful thing that apex predators such as great horned owls that play a similar role to Serengeti lions are alive and well in Forest Park, next door to King's Highway.
Mm-hmm. Why do you want people paying more attention? And is there something that you would like folks who are visiting Forest Park to be attentive to as they're walking through, Dr. Dean?
Yeah, so many things. But one is just to realize that they are sharing that space with all these other species. Like Steve just mentioned, most people don't realize Astrid the Great Horned Owl is probably watching them. This project began with the St. Louis Box Turtle Project, which for years we tracked box turtles. And most people you meet in the park say, oh, I know there's aquatic turtles in the water, but I didn't even know box turtles lived here. So really, when you're in the park, to have your eyes open and your senses to understand all the species that are sharing the space with you. And I think the second big part is really this project is about understanding this amazing biodiverse green space right here in our city, right? And how important green spaces and nature are for human health. Like being out there and doing forest bathing and just feeling connected to nature in this urban setting is just such a big bonus and one of the things our program really puts forward.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Sharon Deem is the director of the St. Louis Zoo Institute for Conservation Medicine, and Steve Blake is an assistant professor of biology at St. Louis University. Steve and Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.